Next case is number 91, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, a corporation versus State of Alabama on the relation of John Patterson, Attorney General. Mr. Carter, may proceed.
The court, please. This cause is here from the judgment of the Supreme Court of Alabama, dismissing and denying a petition for writ of certiorari filed by petitioner seeking to review in the Alabama court an adjudication of contempt and a fine in the sum of $100,000 on the failure of petitioner to submit its membership list pursuant to an order of the Circuit Court of Montgomery County. The issues arose in the following manner. On June 1, 1956, the Attorney General filed a bill of complaints in the Circuit Court of Montgomery County, alleging that petitioner was doing business in Alabama without complying with the Foreign Registration Acts of Alabama, and alleging in addition various other illegal acts. The two that they named was the fact that the allegation was that petitioner had given monies to two persons to induce them to apply to the University of Alabama to test its policy excluding Negroes on the basis of race.
Your state, New York, is the state of incorporation?
Yes, sir.
When you say incorporation, would you mind being a little more specific?
We're incorporated in New York.
Under
the New York membership law.
Well, that's what I meant.
Yes,
it's a particular kind of associated body, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, sir.
Well, under what law did you start in Texas?
I didn't hear you.
Under what?
New York membership.
Membership?
Yes.
You're not
talking. Membership Corporations Act.
Well, that's makes you the body part for how it does.
Yes, sir.
New York membership.
Yes.
What had you done in Alabama? What did they charge you with failing to do in Alabama?
They charged that we had failed to register as a foreign corporation, that we were doing business in Alabama without first complying with its act, which requires foreign corporations to submit their articles of incorporation to the Secretary of State and designate a place of business.
But,
precisely. Yes.
The issue here is whether or not it's the same order of contempt.
Yes, sir. Now, in addition to this failure, they charged that we had done other illegal acts. And as I started to indicate, the acts that they charged were that we had given money, alleged that we had given money to two persons to induced them to enroll at the University of Alabama to test its policy, that we had furnished counsel for these persons, and that we had incited and aided the Montgomery citizens to boycott the bus lines when they were attempting to secure unsegregated seats. On the basis of these allegations alone, and without a hearing and with nothing further, we were, without notice, enjoined from operation. The state asked that we be enjoined from all organizational activities. We were so enjoined, ex parte, and in addition, although this was not requested by the state, the court enjoined us from taking any steps to comply with the law requiring foreign corporations to domesticate. Now, We then filed on July 2nd a motion to vacate, to dissolve the injunction and temporary decree, which is the procedure that one follows under Alabama law. On July 5th, the state came in with a motion requiring us to produce pretrial production of various documents, including a list of our members and various other items. This motion was heard on July 9th. And on July 9th, or July 11th, the court ordered us to produce these various items, including a list of our members, and we cited the specific things that the court asked that's cited on pages 6, 7, and 8 of our petition file here. The court asked that these items be produced on July 16th, but it subsequently extended the time for us to produce until July 25th and then simultaneously continued the hearing on the motion to dissolve to July 25th. We then filed an answer on July 23rd in which we admitted that we had, that we were, had chartered branches in the state, that we had been in Alabama since 1918, that we had not registered under the Act because it was our good faith belief that we were not required to do so, that we had not furnished any monies to anybody to enroll in the University of Alabama, although we did admit that we furnished legal counsel and aid to Miss Lucy to prosecute her suit, that we had not participated in the Montgomery situation, but that we had given financial assistance and legal aid to the persons who were charged with with a violation of the state law for refusing to ride the buses unsegregated. We, in our answer, we said that although we do not feel that we are obliged to obey this law, we attach the requisite form and ask the court to rescind its order and vacate its order, barring us from registering so that we could comply with the law. In other words, we indicated that we were willing to waive whatever contentions we had on that ground. With this answer, we filed a motion to vacate the interlocutory order of the court requiring us to produce on constitutional grounds and on the ground that the issue was no longer, the issue of the getting of these documents was no longer an issue because of the fact that we had made a full answer, and this was a legal question in terms of whether we were or were not doing business. But on our refusal to, the court refused to grant this motion, and on our refusal to give out the names of our members, the court adjudged us in contempt and fined.
Did you tender to the court all of the documents except the members' list?
Not yet. We didn't do that.
Did I want to be sure I heard you, Mr. Carter, say, did you express readiness to file?
Yes, sir. We not only expressed readiness, we had secured the forms and attached them to our answer.
All the things?
Yes, we have.
Were there anything, were there items in the forms which you were unwilling to,
no,
to which you were unwilling to respond?
No, the only thing that the form requires, Mr. Justice Frankfurt, is that you file your articles of incorporation, which incidentally the state already had. They were attached to the complaint, which was filed by the Attorney General, and that you designate your place of business, which the state knew because it's so designated in the Bill of Complaint, and indicate an agent for service. These things we did.
Well, do you mean, Mr. Carter, that ordinarily a foreign corporation needs do more, no more than that
as
to
we,
domesticate in Alabama?
As we understand the law. We secured them from the Secretary of State and attached them to our answer, indicating
we filled them out.
Did
you admit that you did have a place of business in Alabama?
We have a Southeast Regional Office in Birmingham, which was maintained by us, yes.
Did you admit that therein that you were doing business in Alabama?
We Our contention, as I attempt to make it, Your Honor, our contention was that we do not think that we are doing business in Alabama. We do not think that we're doing business in Alabama, and we do not think that this law applies. But we were willing to waive that and comply with the law, and therefore we proceeded to attempt to domesticate. And we indicated that we would file these forms if the court would permit us to do. The court had indicated that we could not even make any attempts to write.
Mr. Carter, did this filled-out form bear the name of any person?
The form was filled out by the organization. I think it has to be signed by the president.
Did on that form appear the name of any person or persons?
It appeared the name of the president, I believe. Okay. I can't be sure of this, but let me say this, that whatever was required in terms of the form, we did. And I'm not really clear as to whether or not the name appeared, but as I remember, the name of the president of the corporation has to be signed.
My question has pertinence, as you doubtless will have inferred, from what is required and what may be required, what may not be required, in the disclosures. Yes. That's why I'm asking.
Well, as I indicated, when we continued to refuse to divulge the names of our members pursuant to the order, we were fined, judged in contempt, and fined $10,000 with a proviso that if we did not comply within 5 days, the fine would be $100,000. Now, on July 20th...
Was there any phrasing by the judge? Was there any statement of what the $10,000 fine was for or against?
Well, I think we cited this, the order of the judge, if the court please, is in the record. All I can say is that the judge indicated that for our refusal to submit the names, as of July 25, we were fined $10,000 and adjudged in contempt. If we did not comply,
that is, if you continued to disobey, that's what the $100,000 is for.
Yes, sir. Now, they're cited as
because the $10,000 fine must have been for refusal.
Yes, sir. They're cited at page 13 on of the, as the appendix, 13A of the appendix to the petition for writ of certiorari.
Thank you,
ma'am. Now, on July 30, which is 4 days afterwards, we came into the trial court with a motion to vacate, stay, or set aside the court's contempt order. And at that time, Mr. Justice Burton, we tendered compliance with the order of the court, with the exception of the portion of the order requiring us to give the names and addresses of our members, and a portion of the order which asked us to submit all of our files, all of our letters, all of our correspondence and so forth, which we contended was burdensome and would completely disrupt our operation.
Well, you were purging yourself of all the contempt except on the members' list.
Yes, sir. I didn't hear you, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, and as I indicated, another item, all which required us to submit all of our files and so forth, which we felt that we could not comply with. We indicated that to the court. This was just physically impossible for us to do, and we so said this in our motion. No, sir, that was denied on July 30th.
Same day?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
In the interlocutory decree, there was an ex parte, that was ex parte, wasn't it?
No, sir. The The temporary restraining order.
Well, now, did that restrain you? Didn't that restrain you from doing any business?
It restrained us from doing business, and yes.
Altogether?
Yes, sir.
It wasn't merely a dislocation, but you were restrained from doing any business.
Yes, sir.
By an ex-party.
Yes, sir. And from doing any business, from soliciting, from maintaining any chapters, from holding any meetings in Alabama. From carrying on any activities in Alabama. That was the ex parte.
That tied you completely. That immobilized you until the restraining order came on, if it did come on, for a hearing. Is that right?
Yes, sir. It never came on, sir.
Never came?
No, sir.
But did you continue under the restraint of that until the contempt proceeding?
We did. We obeyed the order. That is, notified our affiliates that the order was enforced. We had no meetings and we did nothing.
What I want to know is when did the obligation of that restraining order cease? When does that...
The restraining order is still in effect.
So the restraining order continued to run and runs to this moment.
Yes, sir. Because of the fact that because we are in contempt under Alabama law, we have no right to proceed on the merits of the restraining order. Our motion to dissolve was never heard, so that the restraining order has been in effect ex parte since June 1st, 1956.
If I understand that, according to Alabama law, whether decision or statute doesn't make any difference, according to Alabama law, a restraining order putting you for the time being out of business completely continues and has not been reviewed or not being considered with a view to setting it aside or making it permanent, because in the meantime, the state moved for disclosure. Now, you did not fully satisfy the requirement of disclosure granted by the judge. You offered some compliance, but not all of it. He thereupon cast you in contempt, and that, as it were, suspended any action on the restraining order, except that the restraining order still restrains you.
That's the situation precisely.
What happened to the provision requiring payment of fines? That stayed or something?
The provision with respect to the state has made no effort to collect the fine. We don't have, the fact of the matter is, we have no funds in Alabama. There is some question as to whether or not under the conflict rules that Alabama could collect the money. But I think that Alabama has accomplished its purpose, which was to get us out of business and put us out of Alabama. And the state has not proceeded to try to collect the money.
Why is it your motion to dissolve was never heard?
Well, when we filed our motion to dissolve on July the 2nd, it was set down for hearing on July 17th. On July 5th, the state comes in and says for us to disclose our members. On July 9, that was heard and granted. When we refused to, as the hearing on these and objections and so forth, the court continued the hearing, and the time for us to comply, and then continued the hearing on the motion to dissolve, so that it would be behind the hearing on the question of whether or not we would comply with the order.
But then to say they'll not hear it unless you comply with the order.
That's right. That's the exact result of what.
Let me ask you this: under Alabama law, suppose you were to pay the $100,000. Suppose you continued in recalcitrance, in disobedience, never purged yourself by performance, but paid the fine. Is the restraining order, the motion to dissolve, not hearable?
Well, I would say.
In short, there is this extensive restraining order. In the meantime, the state asked for some disclosure, and you feel that certain things you shouldn't disclose, and you stand pat on that. Does that mean you have to live under that restraining order continuously?
Your Honor, because it may well be that if we were to pay the $100,000, that we would be considered purged of contempt, but then we would be ordered to comply with the order. We would be found in contempt again, and so the whole thing would go on.
You mean the discovery order?
Yes, sir. The discovery order, the interlocutory.
Is this a civil contempt order that is purchable, or is this an outright fine as for a criminal contempt?
The Supreme Court of Alabama has held that it's civil contempt. Supreme Court of Alabama has held that it's civil contempt. If it were criminal contempt, the fine could only be $50. So that the Supreme Court has held that we contended under the law of Alabama and some of the cases of the Supreme Court that this should be considered as criminal contempt and the fine $50. But in this opinion, the Supreme Court disagrees and holds that it is civil contempt.
Well, $100,000, this isn't a bargain. You don't say you can either obey or pay $100,000. It isn't that kind of thing.
No, sir.
You can't imagine it.
Well, on July 10th, capture the sequence of events, this motion was denied. We then went to the Supreme Court of Alabama with a motion to stay or set aside or the order of the lower court pending review on certiorari, pending the filing and disposition of a petition for certiorari in the Supreme Court.
This was to set aside the order of contempt?
To hold the order of contempt, set it aside and stay further proceedings or set it aside until we had an opportunity to file a petition for writ of certiorari in the Supreme Court of Alabama. The Supreme Court of Alabama on July 31st, we had a hearing before the court, ruled that the only way for the Supreme Court to review contempt adjudications was on certiorari. But that since we had not filed a petition for certiorari, that it did not consider that it could interfere with the action of the court insofar as the contempt adjudication is concerned. At that point, and even before this decision was handed down, the circuit court issued its second order of contempt, which found that we had failed to comply within 5 days and found us in further contempt and fined us for $100,000. On August the 8th, we filed a petition for writ of certiorari in the Supreme Court of Alabama. This was denied as insufficient after hearing on August the 13th. We filed another petition on August 20th, and that petition was, the opinion was handed down, which is in the record here.
What was the ground of insufficiency on the first petition?
Well, Mr. Joseph Harlan, I'm not clear. I think it was technically that we had failed to put in the petition certain allegations which we set forth fully in our brief, but they held that we hadn't technically complied with their rules. Now, in its opinion on December 6th, the Supreme Court of Alabama refused to grant the petition for writ of certiorari on the ground that if we had desired to seek a review on the merits of the order to disclose, the interlocutory order to disclose, that the proper method for us to have sought such a review was by a petition for writ of mandamus. That on certiorari, adjudications of contempt on certiorari, that the court is concerned only with jurisdictional matters, that it has to find that the order is void on its face, that there is no jurisdiction of the parties, or that contempt was not in fact committed, or that the citation was in some way insufficient. And the court found jurisdictionally and so forth that this case met all these requirements and therefore that the circuit court had the authority to find us in contempt and had jurisdiction. And in addition, even though it said we don't have to, the court went to the merits of the order and held that on the merits, the court below had the authority to issue the order itself. Now, the very outset of these proceedings, we are met with the question of whether this court has jurisdiction. And we think that it unquestionably has. We take that position, as we have indicated in our brief, under the authority of Rogers versus Alabama.
Mr. Carter, will you clear me up on this? You read the Supreme Court's opinion as saying initially that this should have been by way of mandamus, not certiorari.
To raise the issues that we want raised,
yes. Yes, but then after having decided that the circuit court did have jurisdiction, treating it as within those limits under certiorari, then went on to deal with the merits.
Yes.
Is that to say that the merits were dealt with as if you had applied for mandamus?
No. The court, well, I intend to take the position that that's what happened. But in all fairness to the Supreme Court of Alabama, in all honesty, so far as this decision was concerned, it said that although we don't have to go further, we can stop after we find that the court had jurisdiction and
the no, well, my question is, they could have stopped, as you suggested. But the court, in fact, went on and dealt with the merits.
That's right.
Now, in dealing with the merits, did the court do what it would have done had you come up by way of mandamus?
We think so.
But the court said it was doing it because you didn't file mandamus.
The court said that we don't have to do anything further, but it went on and said that on the merits of the order is valid and should be sustained. We think, and in answer to Mr. Justice Brennan said, we think that in effect, the court indicated that if we had come up on mandamus, it would have sustained the order on the merits, but that's the substance of the opinion.
Now, Mr. Carter, if you conscientiously and unquestioningly concluded that under Alabama law, this should have been raised on mandamus, if that was your clear conviction, then you would think the state court decided it on the state ground, wouldn't you, if you thought that?
No, sir. The reason I say no, sir, is because if I remember a decision of this court in Thomas versus Collins, where this same kind of thing was done, I think that this court said that even though the court indicated that it did not have to go into the merits, since it did go into the merits, the issue was here.
If they said we decided, but I thought you were supposed to Justice Brennan that you said you had honesty to say that they said we don't. Although we talk about this thing, we really go on that ground.
Yes, well, that's true.
Yes. Now, if you thought that's the ground they went on, and if you thought they were right about that ground, then it would be a state ground.
Well, yes.
Isn't that right?
Yes.
All right. But your conjecture is that isn't so.
That's right.
All right.
As we indicated in our petition for writ of certiorari, we think that what Alabama has done is to seek here to unfairly defeat our right to have this case reviewed for federal rights, which we think are here, under the guise of local practice.
By that time, it's too late to proceed by mandamus.
We think so, although, Mr. Justice Burton and I, there are some decisions in Alabama where a person has come up to the Supreme Court on a petition for a writ of certiorari or a petition for writ of mandamus, and the court says you've taken the wrong proceeding, but we will treat it as the proper proceeding, as a petition for writ of mandamus. They did not do it here, so that.
Well, Mr. Carter, if we were to agree with your interpretation of what we've done here, would you then now have to argue the question you're about to argue? This is not an alternate ground.
Yes.
That they unfairly, under the guise of state practice, defeated your right to hear.
That's right. Yes,
we don't even get to it if we agree with your first one.
Yes, sir.
In Alabama, are petitions for certiorari ever treated as petitions for mandamus and decided on that basis by the Supreme Court?
Well, there is a case, the only case I know of, quite frankly, which was decided in which an Alabama, I think it was in a divorce action, went to the Supreme Court of Alabama on a petition for writ of mandamus. The court held that this should be from contempt on a petition for writ of certiorari. But since you've asked for such other and further relief, we're going to grant, we're going to treat it as a petition, as a proper petition. I think I can cite that case for you. It is Armstrong versus Green, which is cited at 67 second, 834. We do not cite it in our brief.
Your contention is that a fair reading of Alabama cases makes clear that, as a matter of fact, answer certiorari does go beyond the mere technical questions of jurisdiction.
There's no question.
That's your position.
Yes.
And since that's Alabama law in other cases, they can't refuse it in a case involving a federal right. That's your position.
That's our position, that that under Alabama law, the same kind of questions that we have here, which go to the validity of the order, disobedience of which led to the citation of contempt, and which raised constitutional questions involved, Alabama has decided those cases on a petition for writ of certiorari from contempt. And in fact, we go further. Insofar as we understood Alabama law, this was the customary way in which issues of this kind were raised and treated. And so that we think that under the, we've decided the cases of which we think are in point in our petition for writ of certiorari in Alabama law, and we think that the court has jurisdiction. Now, before I go into the argument on the merits, I think it's best for me to try to recapitulate what I think are the orders which are before the court and before this court which we ought to be reviewed. We think that the temporary restraining order, which was involved in this case, which barred us from all activities and in fact ousted us from the state and barred us from complying with the law. The interlocutory order requiring us, among other things, to disclose the identification and the addresses of our members. The first adjudication of contempt and the fine of $10,000, which was entered on July 25. The second adjudication of contempt and the fine of $100,000, which was issued on July 31. And the order and judgment of the Supreme Court of Alabama denying the petition, our petition for writ of certiorari. I didn't hear you, sir.
How about their affirmance of the decree for contempt?
Yes, sir. This is the... I meant that when I said that the order and judgment of the Supreme Court of Alabama in this case, in this opinion.
That is the one thing that is actually here on the proceeding, isn't it?
Yes, sir. Yes, that opinion is here on the proceeding.
That's what we affirm or reverse it, isn't it?
That's right. That's right.
Not the rest.
Well, we think that the rest is here, and I would like to indicate how in a moment. It's our contention that the entire proceedings in Alabama are void, that the Alabama authorities had no authority and no power and no to oust us from the state, that we have been deprived of the right to carry on our lawful activities pursuant to a temporary restraining order, the order to disclose the list of our members and these contempt adjudications. We contend that the order to requiring us to disclose the list of our members is a denial of our right, the right of the corporation, and the right of its members to free speech and freedom of association, and is protected by the First Amendment. We contend that if we had disclosed the list of our members, that they would have been subjected to possible harm and threats and fears. We further contend that the punishment for contempt and the fines issued were so vindictive that they in and of themselves, and excessive, that in and of itself constituted a denial of due process. And that the atmosphere in Alabama, which was one of open hostility to our organization, and its members, that this had so insinuated itself into the proceedings in the court that we think that the whole proceedings below was, in effect, a perversion of the judicial process. Now, with respect to the free speech contentions, it's our view that as an organization whose purpose is to seek to improve the status of Negroes in America and to remove color discrimination, that we have pursued this objective in a lawful manner, and that we are entitled, and our members are entitled, to associate together to pursue this objective, and that we have the protection of the Constitution of the United States in so doing. Now, it is true that under the present status of affairs in Alabama, that at the present time our aims are at variance with state power. But the aims of and the objectives of the organization, which are to remove racial and color discrimination from American life are in accord with the rights, privileges, and immunities guaranteed under the federal Constitution. And although Alabama may desire to maintain segregation and so forth, we think that we have a right to pursue our objectives of the removal of segregation, even though it be at variance with the state policy, and that the state policy in this regard has no effect whatever. Now, insofar as our members are concerned and the right of the organization to do this, it is our belief that under the decisions of this court, that our members and the organization are entitled to pursue these objectives free and unfettered from any state control, absent compelling justification. We think that's what the decisions in this court hold, and we think that has been repeated in the two latest decisions that we know of on the subject decided last term, the Sweezy and Watkins. Now, we do not contend, of course, that the state may not control the organization and may not limit its activities in some way. But we do contend that whereas here, First Amendment rights are being invaded, that the balance has to be struck between the necessity for the regulation and the freedom which we feel we're entitled to have. Alabama has offered no justification whatever in any paper filed in this case to warrant the restraint issued or to warrant the order with regard to our members. There is no necessity, no need that has been shown as to why the Attorney General desires to know who our members are. No purpose would be served by it. In fact, what would happen, insofar as we're concerned with this, is that the state is treading on a ground which it has no right to tread. Now, Shirley.
It was not within the power of the trial court in sustaining this motion to require you to give the names and addresses of your members. Not within his power? Was that relevant, in other words, to the lawsuit pending before the court? As to whether or not you were doing business there, and was it within the power of the trial court so to order?
We think it was not. We think not only was it not relevant, we think that the trial court had no authority to order this disclosure because of the fact that our contention is that the right of our members to associate together in the organization, to associate together is protected from enforced disclosure to any state authority. This is our contention. Now, on the question of relevance, which we think is not a basic question, but on the question of relevance, in the light of our answer, in which we had admitted that we had the kinds of operation that we had been carrying on, what we had been doing, the character of our operation, not only in Alabama, but throughout the United States, the question of who our members were had nothing and no relevance forever to the question which was purportedly before the court as to whether or not we were doing business. And besides that, when we offered to register and offered to waive our right to object to Alabama saying whether we were or were not doing business, if there had been any relevance, we could submit that it was lost at that point. There was no issue before the court from which the identification of our members had any relevance whatever. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think so.
Now, it's our feeling that the only purpose of this order to disclose was in order that the Alabama court, the Attorney General, was in fact seeking to use this so that we would be placed with two which we consider unconstitutional conditions. Either we have to comply with the order to disclose and therefore submit to a violation of our right of free speech and right of free association, or we risk contempt and we're ousted from the state as we were and never get an opportunity to test the merits of the order. Now, in our view, the respondents have sought to utilize the subversion cases and the Bryant versus Zimmerman, which we think have no relevance whatsoever in this case. We're not subversive. There's no allegation that we were subversive. There's no allegation, in fact, in the pleadings that we have done anything illegal other than that we have been in Alabama, according to the state's complaint, without registering. And we think that these cases have no purpose here because in those cases where the court felt that the state might require, the federal government, might require some invasion of free speech, that in those instances, the court found that there was some justification for it, which we contend the court cannot find in this particular case. We feel that we think that the record shows that Alabama was using its Foreign Corporations Registration Act in these proceedings as a cloak to require conformity in the state on this issue of segregation as opposed to anti-segregation.
Mr. Carter, I'm not sure that I know your position on the question of the duty to file a certificate to the Secretary of State, if that's the official.
Well,
suppose that was all that was an issue here, what would be your position?
Well, we don't think it is an issue any longer, but we don't think it is an issue.
That's because you proffered the signing of it? That's because you were ready to file that?
Yes.
So that isn't before us then, is it?
We don't think so.
Well,
you offered to file the, pay the charges, the fees, registration fees, and so forth, did you, at the same time?
Yes, sir. We offered to comply so far as the law was concerned.
Well, the reason why states want to have foreign corporations, so-called, file their certificate is in order to protect their own citizens for various reasons, so as to know whom to sue.
Yeah.
Now, you're a membership corporation, which means you're doing business without profit, and therefore the restrictions or the qualifications are different in New York from what they are for business. If you're ready to file, and if the state has a right, or at least there's nothing in the federal constitution to bar Louisiana and Alabama from saying, you must file a certificate. Because if you are engaged in any kind of activity, have an office, you rent something, you may owe the landlord, or the conditions may be in such order, bad order, that the licensee coming in may fall and sue somebody. And they have a right to know whom to sue, who's responsible. Is that right, sir?
Yes, sir.
So that there is a distinction, at least I'd like to put it to you, between requiring, I'm not saying what the legal consequences, there is a distinction between Alabama's right to say, you give us the names of your officers, and you give us the names of people scattered all over Alabama who support your cause, isn't there?
I think so. I think that in Alabama, all Alabama requires for persons to domesticate is that they file the Articles of Incorporation, which lists the persons that are incorporated, and I believe the members of the Board of Directors.
That's the responsible people.
That's right. Now,
you have an objection to that, do you?
No, sir. We don't. We offered to comply. And the reason I think that all of this is, even if we take the position and concede that Alabama had the right to request us to do that, we think that they have no authority to use this as a jumping off ground to do the things that it has done. And we say this for this reason. The law in Alabama requiring foreign corporations to domesticate is to do precisely what you've indicated. Now, technically, admitting that we were doing business, technically only were we in violation because of the fact that Alabama knew that we had a Southeast Regional office. In fact, the matter they attached as an exhibit to their complaint. They served the complaint on us there, and we submitted to the state's jurisdiction. There is no indication at all as between 1918 and 1956, and we have been had affiliates and been doing the same thing in Alabama during that period of time that we in 1918, 1956, that there was ever any effort by any Alabama citizen to sue the corporation, which was defeated because we had not complied.
Carter, that the failure to enforce the law for a period to stops the sovereign from enforcing it later.
We don't argue that at all. We do think that it raises some presumption that this irreparable harm, that's with no other contentions, that this irreparable harm which the state alleged did not in fact take place.
Did the Alabama trial court have legal authority to impose, under the law of Alabama, some penalty of whatsoever kind for the failure to comply within the time prescribed with an order to produce?
You mean the order to produce the names and addresses of our members?
Did the trial court in Alabama have the power to impose some penalty for failure to comply with the order of July 17th?
Well, assuming that the order is a valid order, Justice Whitaker, they would have the power under contempt if we disobeyed it. As I understand Alabama law, if we disobey that order as any other order, we're in contempt of court, and the court has the power to seek to enforce it by its contempt adjudication, fine, etc. But we don't think that they, I don't know of any other power that they had in terms of the order that you're referring to. That's assuming that it was a valid order. But we don't contend that it was a valid order. I mean, that's our position.
Mr. Carter, may I get a little more light from you? It is Alabama law, you say, that when a restraining order is outstanding, if you don't obey it, therefore can be thrown into contempt, you can't raise the validity or the scope of the restraining order. Is that right? That's what you say is Alabama law.
Well, if at any time in the proceedings, court please, I understand Alabama law, and I think that the Attorney General concedes this. If at any time in the proceedings, the result of this order, we are put in contempt, then the whole proceedings is aborted, stopped.
Yeah.
Whatever has happened remains. Now, I would suspect that the Attorney General would then have the right to obtain a default judgment, and which would then perhaps make this appealable.
But you say but you say that that ordinary provision of Alabama law suspending a restraining order does not bar this court from saying that you were thrown into contempt for disobeying a restraining order that exceeded the constitutional speed limit.
Yes.
In that they prohibited you from doing business when there was no relation between that protection given to Alabama and any interests of its. In short, that there was no possible irreparable damage that required such an extreme restriction of your rights. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Although on a restraining order, in ordinary instances, that might be all right. Now, secondly, you say that you were thrown in contempt because you disobeyed a bill for discovery, or whatever it's called, one of the features of which was the disclosure of your membership, and that Alabama had no right to exact from
us.
Are those the two things? What else is there that you complain?
Well, we
as far as I understand, those are the two things.
So we think that the contempt itself is so outrageous that,
the fine?
$100,000 fine, we think that that's...
Now, what do you say to the decision of this court that obedience is due to an order, even though a court may later be found to have improperly issued the order?
As I understood that, that was the distinction that this court made between criminal and civil contempt, and that we have obeyed the temporary restraining order, so that we have not, there is no public defiance of the Alabama court. We disobeyed the order of ordering us to disclose because we thought that this was the only way,
and that's
so
the only
we could
way
preserve
you could
our rights.
So that you're not within the Lewis case.
No, sir.
In that you didn't snap your fingers at the injunctive process.
That's right.
But you were ordered to produce, and you think you were ordered to produce something that the Constitution had no right to ask you to produce.
That's right.
And you stood your ground.
That's
Is that right?
That's right.
Well, a particular provision of that restraining
order. We think that the court below had no jurisdiction, that the court in effect acted arbitrarily, ousted us from Alabama. It had no jurisdiction, no authority to do this under the basis of this record. We think further, if I may just finish, we think further that the Supreme Court of Alabama sustain the authority of the court to issue this temporary restraining order, even under the theory of the contempt which it had, because it said that there had to be jurisdiction in order for it could review jurisdiction on certiorari. So the Supreme... I'm sorry.
I asked you how you got the temporary injunction into
They call it temporary.
Out of the district court, out of the trial court, except by a motion to dissolve, which was never heard. And that all that's here then would be the issue upon whether or not that you were properly cited in the contempt to fine.
Well, the Supreme Court of Alabama had to necessarily, we think, we raised the issue of the temporary restraining order in that court. It held that the court below had jurisdiction to do what it did. Now, in so doing, we contend that it had to go to the question of whether the court had the right to issue the temporary restraining order. Otherwise, it would have to have held that the order to produce constant with it was void. We think that this is very definitely before the court, that not only is the order to disclose and the contempt before the court, but to go back to the initial thing that started the temporary restraining order itself. And our contention is that all of these matters are here and that they should be disposed of by this court.
Mr. Reinhart.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Mr. Justice Whitaker's question is what I would like to concern myself with at the outset, because it goes to the very heart of the case of what this court has to review. Now, the opinion of the Supreme Court of Alabama deals with the Alabama law on certiorari and the limited review which that application or petition for that particular remedial writ is limited to, and that is jurisdiction of the person, jurisdiction of the subject matter, the regularity of the contempt proceedings, for example, whether there was a correct citation, whether there was even a hearing on this contempt. All of those things will be looked at on the face of the record. That is all that you get by certiorari. And that's all this court looked at. It is true, and we do not deny, that the court then went on and discussed certain constitutional questions, not all of the constitutional questions which Mr. Carter has discussed here, but certain of them, such as the question of a corporation's privilege against self-incrimination, whether you can raise the rights of persons, in other words, whether certain of these rights are personal rights and you may not assert the right of another. Those things were discussed, but they were not made the basis of the decision. They said mandamus was the proper way in which to review the order to produce, and that a review of that order to produce was not before that court. And I would like to now enter upon a, I hope, not too lengthy discussion of the common law writs of mandamus in Alabama. It is the established law of Alabama that the review of an interlocutory order of a court of whatever nature is by writ of mandamus, petition, I should say, for writ of mandamus. Ex parte Hart, which is cited in our brief, it is also cited in the opinion of the court. This is, I'm reading now from the record, our transcript of record at page 25. An order requiring defendant to produce evidence in a pending cause may be reviewed on petition for mandamus. Ex parte Hart, 240 Alabama, 642. There's no lengthy discussion of the use of mandamus in that opinion. It was merely assumed that that was the proper way. And it has always, to my knowledge, been the proper way to review an order to produce. For example, other types of interlocutory orders in a pending criminal proceeding, the state made what amounted to a type of motion to have the defendant examined, sent to the Tuscaloosa Hospital for mental examination to determine his present sanity or his sanity at the time of the alleged offense. The trial court refused to send the defendant there as a denial of certain constitutional rights, which are not relevant. The law of Alabama is that when you have an order of that nature, fundamental to the future conduct of the proceedings, that it should be tested by petition for writ of mandamus. The state, in fact, applied for the writ, and I may also say that it's still pending. Not whether the writ, whether it's the wrong remedy, but the question of whether we're entitled to the writ, whether the order is unconstitutional. Now, the orderly, this isn't one of these springs, these traps for the unwary that have been criticized at all. This is a very orderly way to proceed in these matters, and a very logical way to proceed in these matters, because what happens? As in this case, on the 11th of July, there is an order to produce at a future time. What is the remedy? File a petition for writ of mandamus in the Supreme Court of Alabama, and they contest every single constitutional question in concerning the justification of that order, the questions of its relevancy. All of those questions may be gone into. But this petitioner didn't choose that path. He waited until the 11th hour. I'm a little ahead of myself. I should say he waited until the 23rd of July and then filed an answer. Now, that answer, I must disagree with counsel for the petitioner, is a rather odd type of answer, in that he says, well, we do maintain an office and we do have a couple of employees there. We don't think we have to register, but we would be willing to register. But they never really come out and say we're doing business in Alabama. And that is an extremely important issue, despite the tender of compliance with the registration statute. The statutes on that are set out in petitioner's brief at page 35. They are. There is more than that. And, of course, even compliance with registration means that you can't exceed whatever powers you have. You can't run counter to Alabama's laws. There's all of those things involved.
Well, Mr. Reinhart, those statutes of 35, do I read them accurately that Section 192 requires the filing of a certified copy of articles of incorporation under seal and so forth, signed by the President and Secretary, designating at least one known place of business and an authorized agent or agents residing thereat, that is, within the state. Now, that's all, isn't it? Anything else?
And but there's a very small filing.
Yes, $10 or something like that.
As a matter of fact, that's one of the important questions and the reason for the relevancy of the documents requested. Because the gravamen or the theory of the state's case is not merely you ought to do it now regardless of what you've done in the past. And you can pay your petty little fee here and do this and go and sin no more. We think that the state has... I didn't wish to get into this, but we think the state has a power to exclude...
What I was interested in at the moment, this is all that the organization was required to do to domesticate, as we've been using that.
That is correct.
Yes.
As far as just coming in, if when a corporation first comes to Alabama or decides they want to, they come in and they file these papers,
yes.
I think that they are...
I'm sure it must be true in Alabama, as I know it is in New Jersey, that very often foreign corporations who have the same obligation in my state that they do in yours, maybe they're quite a while before they make these filings. That must be so in your state, too, isn't it?
I have no detailed information on that. We would take the position that they should do that before they start business.
Oh, I know. They take that position. The Secretary of State of New Jersey takes the same position. But I'm sure that a great many of them don't get around to doing it for some time. They don't all do it the first day they show up.
I can't answer that question directly. I simply do not have the information.
Well, are you making a point of the fact that there was a delay here?
A great delay, a many years delay.
Whatever it was. A year, 2 years, whatever it may be. Is
yes, we are.
Making a point?
Yes, we're making that. It's one of the most important matters in the case once we get to the question of whether the whole merits of the case are subject to review. Yes, we do.
After all, was this corporation notoriously doing business in this state?
I would say yes, sir.
Yes. And they've been notoriously doing business for a good many years.
Can only speak of my own knowledge, which would at least go back for several years, 2 or 3 years at a minimum.
And probably before that.
Yes, I think, in fact, the petitioner admits that they have taken certain activities for a great many years, but denied, essentially, that was doing business in Alabama.
Well, I know they do that, but I mean, from the point of view of the importance to you of their disobedience from the state point of view, to file a certificate or to apply for it, is that right?
Yes.
All I'm saying is that... if they've been doing as notorious business as I should think they could take judicial notice of, state officials also have this knowledge and therefore it has some bearing on whether overnight you need to put them out of business by a restraining order.
I think that would be correct if we ever got to the motion to dissolve the temporary restraining order, which I don't think we ever do get to, really.
Well, Mr. Ryan, one last question about this. This statute speaks of designating a known place of business and an authorized agent. Authorized for what?
Service of process.
So that the statute has a single purpose, doesn't it? To have a place at which the officers of the state required to serve process upon it knows where it can be reached and upon whom to make service.
That is the most important...
But that is the purpose of the
statute. That's the purpose of this statute. I should like to point out that there is a constitutional provision that is not merely a statutory provision.
Oh.
And in fact, the constitutional provision is held to be self-enabling. And so it's a question of whether you can look at these and say you have everything, though the statute doesn't say why it is. I mean, the constitutional provision, Section 232, doesn't say what it's purpose is except to protect people. for this service.
Well, I mean, there's nothing unusual about this. I think every one of the 48 states has an identical statute.
There's a question of franchise taxes involved also, which they are supposed to. But they, before, to get an exemption from certain taxes, you must establish the nature of your corporation, too. And, of course, we're not making a great point of that in this particular case. Rather, we...
Mr. Reinhart, if a corporation is delinquent in complying with the law, is there any authority in anyone in the state to prohibit them from complying with the law when they are when it's called to their attention?
There is no such statutory authority.
Well, is there any authority?
We think the authority can be found in State X Rel Griffith against Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, a Kansas case.
Well, a Kansas case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, what I'm getting at is this. Has it ever been declared to be the law of Alabama that anybody in the state can prevent them from complying merely because they were delinquent?
There is no case law and no statutory law either.
No case or statutory law. Well, now, then I suppose we'll have to go to what laws we have. And I notice here that the on page 35 of the brief for a petitioner that you just called our attention to, that there are certain penalties prescribed for not complying and for doing business without complying. If that is true, and the state has set those penalties, and there's no other statutory law or no judicial law, aren't those the only penalties that your state can exact?
No.
I think you might as well answer that in the morning. We'll
yes, sir.
Yes, sir.